accession number 20303, reel 6.
Yes, the Hampshire Regiment at the time, the battalion, they were mainly deployed up country in the jungle areas and the smaller towns and villages against hit and run attacks up there. So we were there as a landing party again, more or less in case of civil disobedience, but also guarding civic buildings like the Governor's Palace and legislature, this sort of thing. Really a present, like a deterrent as much as anything else. And fortunately, during our time, nothing really nasty blew up, so that was fortunate. But the Hampshire Regiment had it different. They were the ones taking the rough edge. Yeah.
Did you come across any unpleasantness ashore?
No, not really. But the only people we mixed with, the only people who were pleased to see us, were the Indian indigenous population. You know, the Indian, they're like the middle class people. You know, as you know, in our colonies, we shipped in the Indians to be the shopkeepers and the middle class. And so, I mean, I'd like, for example, on board, we would have a cocktail party, and so it would, the Indian. Of course, this was the resentment in these sort of places. It happens in Africa as well, of course, because the Indians are the affluent ones, and the African origin people tend to be the poorer and the less skilled. Which was, of course, the way we set it up. I mean, this is the way colonial empires were run.
Did anybody make you feel that you weren't wanted?
No, not really. In fact, it is rather interesting. I've reflected on this since. All my time abroad in the Navy, I never ever felt that I was under threat by anybody. You know, this is in Pakistan, whilst I was in Loch Ruthven, we went to Pakistan for 3 weeks, Ceylon, you know, Hong Kong, Japan, been to Kenya when we went to South Africa itself, excepting one place, most strange. When I was on the Tabard submarine in 1953, we went to Algiers. Well, this was the fourth of depot ship and six submarines. We went to Algiers. And at the time, this is when the revolt was on, the French and the Algerians. And the only time ever attacked was the Pal and I. We were ashore in Algiers. And as sailors, you tend to find out of the way places. You're just interested in sort of going down back street to see what's there. And Algiers was quite civilized, bars, you know, being French, you go and have a pastiche and a meal, this sort of thing. Pal and I were walking back to the ship about 7 o'clock in the evening when a gang of youths, about six of them, came down behind us, right? And they were about 30 yards away. And then these stones started whistling down. My chum, called Tiny Little, and I walked down, and these stones came round us. And they came out, sort of shouting out something or other. And I said to my chum, Tiny Little, I said, right, when I give the word, I said, we'll both turn round. I said, you go for the fellow on nearest to you on the left-hand side. I'll go for the fellow on the right-hand side, about six of them. Then I turned around and said, no. And they were about 20 yards away now. We turned around, we went up, and I hit my fella, and he went down. Tiny Little hit his, and he went down. And then the other four ran away, and the other two picked up and ran away. Now, all the time I was in the Navy, that was the only time when there was any aggression and any feeling of that you weren't wanted. I mean, all the other places, you know, Ceylonese were marvellous people. You go ashore in Ceylon, yeah. Yes, nowhere else.
So that incident was in Algiers?
In Algiers, French occupied.
In 53?
In 53.
Is it possible they thought you were French?
Might have possibly thought we were French, yes. I mean, if they were Algerian peasant lads, they wouldn't be too well up on distinguishing who was who. Yes, they wouldn't know. Yeah. After we left British Guiana, it was now December. Where are we? 1955?
63.
Probably coming up 64 now, I should think. Yes, because we were out there a year. And so, anyway, you could look at this up in the history books. When we were told we were going to New Orleans, we thought, New Orleans, this is marvellous. And so, we told we were going to celebrate with the Americans the sesquicentennial of the Battle of New Orleans. Well, first of all, none of us knew what sesquicentennial was, but it's 160 years, apparently. If my memory serves me right, or I can work it out. And the Battle of New Orleans, which is the Battle of New Orleans, never heard of it. Then somebody said, you know that song, we fired our guns and the British kept a coming, and we fired our guns, and there were many as it were a moment ago. He said, that's the Battle of New Orleans. And when we researched the Battle of New Orleans, what it was Stonewall Jackson, right? He had about 200 sharpshooters fighting us. And they got the other side of a swamp at New Orleans and behind bales of hay and things like that. And the British Army came on. And of course, they were all wearing red coats. They were sort of used to fighting Napoleon's troops and things like that. And they just came on with drums playing across this marsh, and they were absolutely mown down. And we went to New Orleans, all trained diplomats, to help the Americans celebrate this. Anyway, New Orleans is marvellous. There's only one trouble with it. People in New Orleans don't sleep. Gosh, honestly, you're on the go all the time. Never known nightlife like it. But that was a marvellous trip. And all the officers, we were taken up to the capital, Baton Rouge, for a reception in the state and governor's mansion. That was marvellous. We went out with motorcycle riders, the great big Cadillacs. That was rather special, that was, yeah. Anyway, Americans being very hospitable. Gave us a lovely time.
And then?
And then, right, it gets a bit more tricky now, because one of the reasons I went through for a commission was, as I've explained to you, the Navy was a hard life. There's no doubt. I mean, once you were commissioned, life was entirely different. I mean, your life completely changed. I mean, you had the wardroom, you had better food, you were waiting on by stewards, you had duty-free drinks. It was the life of Riley as an officer. It was really marvellous, right? So you lived in the life, had the life of luxury. But of course, it was still naval discipline. Your life wasn't your own. The Navy owned you. In fact, it owned you more as an officer. And in my mind was, right, it was a hard life. And the thing about going through for a commission was you could retire on a pension from the Navy at 37. Now, the reason for this is the sailor has to go on till 40. But when they formed the Fleet Air Arm before the war, they realised that they didn't want old pilots and old observers. So, but if you're going to invite somebody to come in as a pilot or observer into the Royal Navy, as an officer, you've got to give them a career structure and give them a pension. Because of that, the decision was made to grant pilots and observers pensions at 37. Well, immediately a cry went up that somehow or other was listened to in Admiralty. And so all officers were granted the opportunity to retire at 37. Well, as soon as I was approaching my 37th birthday, I said, enough's enough. I've been wearing a navy blue suit since the age of 14 when I joined the Exmouth. And so 33 years is enough for me. No, 23 years is enough for me. So I left the Navy. I resigned my commission and I came out of the Navy on pension. Now, there was another reason I wanted to do this, was because as a seaman officer trained in the skills of war in the same way as an infantry officer is. Well, you can't apply those skills in civilian life. So I thought to myself, right, what I want to do, by the time I'm 40, get a piece of paper that says I'm qualified in something. And I obviously in the Navy taught naval subjects to sailors and officers lots of times as an instructor. And so it gave me a sort of the desire. I could obviously do it. And I thought, right, in that case, I'll extend that and go into teaching. So, fortunately, the qualifications I obtained to pass for a commission educationally were sufficient to take me to a teacher's training college. So I left the Navy at 37 and then applied to join King Alfred's College as a teacher and trainee. So then I went to King Alfred's College in Winchester and trained in geography to be a teacher, a two-year mature students course, which was absolutely marvellous. Happiest 2 years of my working life.
And you eventually became a teacher?
So I became a teacher. And I took geography as my main subject, with the idea I would go in secondary, having taught sailors and officers, you know, naval subjects. But when I got there, talking to people, they said, don't go secondary, for goodness sake. You know, you're part welfare officer, part policeman, you know, it's absolute murder. And the comprehensive system had just come in, and there were grammar school teachers having to teach these comprehensive, you know, kids, leaving in droves and all this. So and then people said to me, go primary. This is children up to 11. And if you teach primary, you have one class that's yours all day long. But the big thing is, in primary, you are the best teacher in the world to your kids, you know, over here you've got children. I mean, they absolutely idolise their teacher, don't they? You know, they do anything for you, you know. And so I went primary. And I taught the younger children.
How do you feel now about having served in the Navy?
Well, I could give you a quick resume, because the Navy came into my later life. Right. I taught for 11 years, so I was about 39. Would it be? Well, no, about 40. I left the 37 one night when I left the Navy. So I got a job as a housing officer at Fareham District Council for about 9 months before I went to college. So I qualified at the age of 40. I went to teach for the Hampshire Education Authority, went in two schools, and I got promotion up to a grade 3, became head of maths, and also the art and craft and drama. I did both and got promotions on those fields. And then, after I'd been teaching 11 years, I just turned 50, heading on for 51. We're now talking 1970. There was the demographic trough occurred in schools. The birth rate had fallen in the early 70s, right? And when it got to 1980, there was about 20% children of 5 or 6 year olds coming into schools, into primary schools. You know, the demographic trough that occurred. And primary school, the first one to hit it. And they had to lose a lot of primary teachers. And so what they decided to do was, if you were in a primary school where you had to lose a member of staff because your school roles were dropping, any teacher over the age of 50 could volunteer for voluntary redundancy and get paid a pension if they served till 60. And I read this, and I thought, they're telling me I've taught for 11 years, and if I retire, they're going to enhance my pension for 9 years. I didn't have a job to go to. I thought, this is too good to be true. So I put in for it. And I was the only person in our school. We had to lose three teachers. And the other were married ladies, and they didn't want to lose their job. And so I got it. So I left when I was coming up for 51 on this scheme. So I've now on my second pension, a Navy pension at 37, school teacher's pension at 51. And so I thought, what do I do now? I went down to the Labour Exchange, it was called, then, they had a thing called the Professional Executive Register, told this chap what had happened to me. I said, no, I said, I'm looking for another job. So he said, have you got any ideas? So I said, well, my background, maybe some sort of official, maybe, you know, immigration or something like that. So he said, well, let me think, he said. And then he looked at me, he said, I know just the thing for you. I said, really? He said, technical author. And I didn't really know what technical authors did. Then, of course, he explained, you know, you buy an iron, the instructions, you know, in the pamphlet, nuclear power stations, there's 40 volumes, how it works. So, anyway. So he said, now the thing is, he said, the Manpower Service Commission run a course. He said, I could arrange for you to go on a 2-month course, technical authorship course. And he said, of course, we don't run these courses unless there's going to be a job. We run the courses where there's skill shortages. So I said, put me down then for it. And they were going to pay me all these allowances, travelling expenses and all this money to go on this course. Now, the course could have been held anywhere, couldn't it? It could have been Hull, Liverpool, anywhere. The course was run at Fareham, 8 miles from where we're sitting. And so he picked up on the phone. I went to, it was a private company that did it, called Inter Europe, ran this course, the Manpower Service Commission, went down to see him, the manager down there, told him my background. He said, you got everything we need. You've got this technical background, because you're a naval officer, you're being torpedoed and submarine. And he said, you've got teaching skills. He said, that's what you want for an author. So, about 4 weeks later, I started the course. We started the course at 9 o'clock. The instructor came into the room at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, for the afternoon session. He said, John, he said, I forget the manager's name, he said, but the manager said, will you go and see him when you know, we... lectures are finished. So I said, sure. When I went down to see the fella, he offered me a job working for the company. I thought, I don't believe this. I've started the first day of this company in the course. He offered me a job with them. Well, as it was, I was in the Submarine Old Comrades Association, secretary here in Southampton. And I happened in one of our meetings to tell some of my chums, well, one of them was an engineer working in the Vickers Design Office in Southampton, Vickers being the big shipbuilders. And they had a design office there. So I told him what I was doing. Next time month went to the meeting. This fellow was there, Mike Keeley, and he said, John, I hadn't given this other chap. And I said, well, wait till the end of the course. I'm not sure what's coming. When I went to the next Submariners meeting, Mike Keeley said to me, John, he said, our manager said, will you go and see him, he said, because he'd like to offer you a job as a technical author. I thought, I don't believe it. So I was doing this course, the technical, and I had two job offers. So the first one would have been working at the Ministry of Defence Establishment on Portsdown Hill, at the Admiralty Research Establishment. Now, Mike Keeley, as a vicar's man, the Weapons Design Office liaised with him. He went up to work. So I said to him in the end, I said, now look, am I better off with Inter Europe working up the Admiralty Research Establishment or working with you, vicars? He said, come to us in Vickers, which is down in Southampton. So that's what I did. And then, I've been there 6 months, I've written one book, and then one day, the manager called me into the office and said, John, he said, we've got a special job come up. He said, it's going to take about a year. He said, but there's a special book to be written for the Navy. He said, it's to do with special intelligence. And we were completely secure, bars on windows and time locks and everything. He said, this place isn't secure enough. He said, you've got to work out the Admiralty Research Establishment. You'll be up there on contract as a contractor writing this book. Well, couldn't tell me anymore because he didn't know. So I went up and saw the people up there because I'd been nominated.
This is in London?
No, Admiralty Research Establishment here. I was working in Southampton. And I ended up on this special intelligence work. Some of our ships were being fitted with this special listening devices, had to go on a course at GCHQ, learning all about all this eavesdropping they do and everything else like that. And it was going to be a year's job. And what was funny, Margaret's mother lives up in Scotland. She lives at Glenrothes, right?
This is your wife.
Wife's mother at the time. And I was told I had to go to American base at Edsel. But I wasn't to tell anybody where I was going. It was a secret base, all underground. Actually, it was an RAF drone. And I wasn't to tell anybody. I had to take my passport up with me to get into this American base. So anyway, it's only about 40 miles from Margaret's mother. So I thought, well, when I go up there, when I leave, I might have time to drop into Glenrothes and see Margaret's mum. So Margaret, when she was talking to mother next, she said, John's coming up to Scotland. She said, oh yeah, where's he going? So he said, she said, he can't say because it's a secret base. And Margaret's mother said, oh, well, that'll be Edsel. Anyway, so there I was. I ended up on Special Intelligence. But what was funny about that, and so the job went for a year. In the end, I was there 4 years later. And the government then at the time decided that private contracts should go to competitive tender every 4 or 5 years. And so the contract I was on had to go to competitive tender. 9 companies bid for this particular work. There was me and 3 engineers on the job, the Special Intelligence, very secret, hush-hush job. Now, it was a need-to-know job. Any company bidding for it had to employ us. It's crazy, really. And so we had Marconi, Elliott Automation, Plessy. All these companies were bidding for this contract because what they wanted it for was because there was another generation of equipment coming. They wanted the foot in the door. And British Aerospace won it at Bracknell. And so I went on Christmas holiday as a vicar's man, came back 10 days later after Christmas as a British Aerospace employee. At the same time, having negotiated an increase in pay. Lo and behold, 4 years later, the same thing happened again. And now a company called Shrewsbury Technology got the contract. I mean, and we all transferred across to Shrewsbury Technology. It was a crazy system, but working up on this special project all the time. So it was a nice way to end. And I retired when I was 65. Yeah, so that is me.
Can I just go back to what were they called, the Phantom Ditchers?
Oh, the Phantom Ditchers, yes.
Could the ship do anything about them?
Well, I'll give you an example. When we were on Loch Ruthven, out in the Persian Gulf, we had a Phantom Ditcher strike. And in fact, it was the bell went missing. We were anchored off Bahrain, and the bell was on the quarterdeck, kept there. And then one particular watch, the quartermaster was going around, and he noticed the bell was missing, so he reported it off the watch, and shortly after was the panic, what's happened to the bell? And so it was a search the ship, and so it was deduced that somebody had thrown it overboard. So we knew we had a Phantom Ditcher. Well, we had 2 standard divers on board. Standard diving, as you know, the hard helmet you see and the suit. And so that morning, the 2 standard divers, they got their diving suit up on deck, got the pump out of the diving store, and got all the weights and got everything ready for a dive. Then it was stand easy. So we're talking about 10:30, 10:45 in the morning. So stand easy, everybody disappears down the mess for a cup of tea. When the divers came back from their cup of tea, the diving suit was missing and the diving helmet was missing. They'd been ditched over the side. So the Phantom Ditcher had struck again. Now, the way the Navy played this was to make it hell for the ship's company. And so, what happens then? The ship's company are told that from then on, they're going to be 10 sentries placed around the upper deck at all times. Now, a frigate is a lock-class frigate. It's not a very big ship. And from then on, 5 each side, day and night, all the ship's company, right, chief and petty officers, had to stand. Now, of course, the philosophy behind this, where sailors might treat it as a skylark, that they got a Phantom Ditcher, it's a bit of fun, you know, because it doesn't touch them. When they're doing all these extra duties, they don't like it. And, of course, a Phantom Ditcher is sitting on the mess, and people are saying, God, strangle this devil when I find him, you know. Yeah, and that is a very effective antidote. Mm. But of course, more serious things happen, especially in the engine room, because you found nuts and bolts were putting down in bearings and sand in bearings, sabotage ships. And this was all people being disgruntled with the Navy, mainly in the 50s. And this, I mean, changes were forced on the Navy by this sort of thing.
You're also telling me about a gentleman who had served in the Navy in the war, and about an incident he told you about which he felt illustrated the attitude of officers towards him when they came back from Norway.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was very much this us and them. And, I mean, there was a standing joke in the Navy. He used to go like this: "Oh, Captain spoke to me today. Oh, yes. What do you say? Get out the bloody way." You know, this is the sort of philosophy behind it. Anyway, this chap was on a submarine in the early stage of the war during the Norwegian campaign. And they were doing their patrols off the Norwegian coast and got heavily depth charged whilst they were doing this. And they came off one patrol. It was actually Blythe in Northumberland that was their base. And so people departed their accommodation. Next morning, he was walking back towards the submarine, and he passed the captain, and he just saluted the captain and said, "Good morning, sir." And the captain just walked past, completely ignored him, didn't look in his direction, reply, or even salute him. And this was the attitude. And he thought, my God, here we are, all supposed to be all one ship's company, facing the enemy, and this is what we've got. And this was the attitude of the officers in the Navy. So greater part of them.
If that was the attitude of the ratings towards the officers, or the officers towards the ratings, what about relations between ratings and petty officers?
By and large, that was quite good. Yes. Yes, by and large, that was good. Yeah. Because petty officers, see, were former sailors, and they'd come up the same way. Suffers the same conditions, you know. I mean, the Navy, just take a simple example of the way you slept in Navy ships in hammocks. Now, there wouldn't be enough places in your mess, hooks. You slipped over the table. There wouldn't be enough hooks for you to sling your hammocks. And you were then forced to wander passages trying to find brackets that you could put your hammock on, and things like that. But there was no officer interested, and you didn't have a place to sleep or anything like that. That you know, there was no care of the men like that at all. Yeah.
Are you glad you went into the Navy?
By and large, I wish what I'd done later, knowing my capabilities, I wish I hadn't. I certainly wish I hadn't gone into submarines, because submarines hold up your career. Because once you get on a submarine, it's such a close-knit organisation. No captain's going to recommend you for promotion if it means you're going to leave your submarine, for example. So, by and large, no, I wish I hadn't, knowing I could have gone on to do something else quite well, you know, with what's turned out since. But then again, you just don't know, do you? I mean, there we are. Just Hitler affected everybody's lives in those days, and that's the end of it. But I just, you know, as it is, made it work out for me.